The theme for this month is actually a hyphenated one, identity and stories. We're all unique persons and we each have a different story. The chapters of each story record the life process as each of us encounters a widening world. We start with the genes we are given and the people who surround us as small children, move through a widening education, and finally out into the world. Within these chapters come all the details that make each of us unique. We have no control over the early stages. We develop some autonomy over the years, but as long as we live in the world, we can never be completely autonomous. As adults, the things we choose and the constantly changing things we can't change become part of our story, and how we deal with them is who we become. The final chapter does not end until we do. Please excuse the use of my own personal experience as illustrations. I hope you'll follow along, inserting your own text into my narrative and raising your own questions. We're all born with a combination of genes determining things like skin, eye, and hair color, over which we have no control. I sure wish I'd got better hair. But that didn't come with my genes. You win some and you lose some in the gene lottery. Where childhood environment is concerned, I was lucky to have a stable home from which to venture forth. Over time, I've known adults who had been adopted, many of whom searched for information about birth parents, in some cases with happy results and in others with emotionally devastating results. Theoretical discussions of nature and nurture, the kind we all have over a beer on Saturday night when we're young, lose their theoretical essence when they are adjusted in life. I also have known people who were damaged by the environment of their first home. And like many of those who've become my friends over the years, it never occurred to me as I grew up to question the assigned gender of my childhood. I had no siblings, but the fact that both my parents were the eldest in their families certainly produced the strong sense of duty and responsibility in my family that research has shown tends to come with that place in the family order. Those who are middle children, or the baby of the family, have been shown to have quite different life experiences from that of their eldest sibling. On one side, my heritage is Huguenot and Quaker. On the other, determinedly nonconformist Methodist. Someone once called me a born skeptic. That theologically questioning heritage may have had something to do with it, and maybe it's genetic. Time and place. My time of birth was not an easy one. The Depression and World War II were not an optimum time to be born. My age cohort is much smaller than normal. But as a child, you're only aware of adult tensions. You're all younger than I am. So the socioeconomic influence of your time of birth will be quite different. Place. I was raised in a strongly Protestant family in a Catholic neighborhood and in a city where religion was and still is under the surface an important signifier. I went to the public school. My playmates went to the Catholic school. Mother tongue is a dominant aspect of identity. Interesting to note that it is called mother tongue and not father tongue. Witness the many current fights over autonomy based on language and the culture it creates. Spain and Catalan. Also witnessed by attempts to destroy inconveniently persisting native languages. We don't have to look outside Canada for that one. The necessity of acquiring a new language causes problems for refugee families. Although English is my mother tongue, I grew up in a city of immigrants who came from Central and Eastern Europe to work in the factories, and which also had a large French-speaking population dating back to the 18th century. The dominance of my language was never threatened, But I also understood at an early age that other languages dominated other spaces. Looking around me, the question, who am I, seems to have arisen at a very young age, and from a national perspective. I grew up in Windsor, Ontario, more than a stone's throw from the American border, but probably not more than 2 or 3 football fields away. From the foot of my street, you could see Americans moving around on Belle Isle, the Detroit Park. There was no CBC station in Windsor. Except for the local newspaper, all the media were American. My mother had first cousins in Detroit, and we went back and forth for Saturday dinners for many years. I had first cousins in Niagara Falls, New York. We were close to these American relatives, but even as a child, I could see that somehow, as Canadians, we were different. The question of how come has been an ongoing focus for much of my life. Other than questions of border, I found that my place of birth was surprisingly formative, as it has been for so many others. In Nova Scotia, I'm from away. Although I haven't lived in Windsor since I was 17, when I drive to the far west end of Highway 401, the landscape starts to look right. I've become aware that I need to be near water, probably a river like the one I grew up on. Lakes don't do it for me very much, but I can handle the ocean because the water is moving. But for me, that landscape, that flat, fertile agricultural land, and the busy river left an imprint. I'm reminded of a friend who moved back east from a super job in Vancouver. And when he was asked why, he said, "Wrong ocean." We all have an image of a space to which we belong. Moving on to the next chapter of our story, most of us step out from home, some willingly and some of necessity. Continuing my good luck, I managed to get away to university, which was not easy in the Windsor depressed economy. Pay my tuition and expenses with summer jobs and a small scholarship and graduate at 20. But those 4 years placed me permanently in English-Canadian culture. Choice and autonomy begin to have more prominence. I did not follow my friends into the high school teaching profession. Instead, I learned to type and take shorthand and went off to Toronto to work. Such an early start in the job market, I was able to test several types of employment and gradually develop a sense of where I might belong in the wider world. By now you know more about me than you probably wanted to know, and I'm sorry about that. However, forming friendships and intimate relationships is an important further chapter in our development of a self. With all the pluses and minuses and successes and failures of relationships that are part of this never-ending stage of life, not everyone finds a relationship that adds emotional security to their identity. And for those individuals, the resulting insecurity becomes part of their story. In my day, marriage meant a loss of identity for a woman. When I became a Mrs., my credit cards were revoked, and I could not have an individual bank account. As those archaic rules gradually changed, I had to take action, to take steps to assert my personal identity. While we do face the who am I question, often many times in the course of our lives, we're less likely to explore the who are we and the who are they. As we move from being one person to being part of many relationships, the choice of we is the area in which we exercise the most autonomy. A neighborhood, a work team, a member of a club, some of us join a church. Unitarians, whose principles require that diverse points of view be integrated into the whole, are experts at defining we. Many organizations are defined by what they do, and that becomes part of us when we join them. If you've chosen to join a rowing club, a bridge club, a service club, volunteer with a specific organization, that choice tells others where your personal interests lie and what your values and abilities might be. You may even borrow that chosen we to identify yourself. How often do you say, I'm a Unitarian? And somebody says, who are you? Oh, I'm a Unitarian. When we moved to Montreal, the first thing people wanted to know was what church we went to. That was going to be our pigeonhole in that city. When we moved here, it was which political party we supported. That's when I discovered that the McDonald's from Cape Breton do not vote the same way as the mainland McDonald's. Affiliation reflects a choice and can become identity in the eyes of others, even when we don't see it that way. Expanding the question of we and they. Professionally, as a historian in pre-Confederation Canada, I've always been curious about when, how, and if people shared the identity of their country of origin, politically, socially, and culturally. The answer, of course, is that some did and some didn't, some do and some don't. When did they come to think of themselves as Canadians? Again, some did very quickly. For some, it took several generations of hyphens, and some just never accepted Canada. There are multiple tomes on the question of national identity, published from many political, social, disciplinary perspectives. For the purpose of studying the early 19th century, my American colleague and I isolated three factors that were common to all the identity theorists. To have a national identity required a sense of a shared past, a transcendent or inclusive ideology, and other who defines what you are not. These factors are also useful as we examine our own lives. For myself, I have no problem with these signifiers. The last of my ancestors arrived in 1840. Other than the shared culture of Western European civilization, my tribe's historical memory is entirely Canadian. In national terms, my inclusive ideology is Canadian. My other has never been the different tribes within, always the external American other. In the years I worked with the CUC, my inherent sense of Canadian difference frequently got me into trouble with the UUA administration, but it also worked to advance the cause of a separate Canadian Unitarian experience. Canadians, of course, are all known for the explaining at first level of identity that we're not Americans. Everyone here has a personal identification with the past they share. Sometimes it's a carefully selected past and a choice of with whom they share it. Certainly there's choice involved in the persona we present to the world as part of the many we's of our lives. Where we really have to watch it in our present world of ideological conflict is that we don't instinctively revert to a detachment from they, from the terrible other. As Unitarians, we do have a lengthy history, both in Canada and internationally, a shared past that we tend to put aside as we have a very bad habit of putting it aside, as we focus on the future. Our statement of influences and principles constitute an inclusive ideology, and our desire to bring people into our circle is an acknowledgement of the existence of other. Always remember that for many non-Unitarians, we are the other. We cannot control loss, separation, tragedy, drastic change, deteriorating health, and all the other miserable things that befall us. We can control how we respond to them. We're always in a process of becoming. We're always asking questions. As an ongoing exercise, we each need to ponder who we are, how we come to be here in this space, and where this takes us as we move forward individually and collectively. What's the next chapter in the story?